Hi, this is John Jenkins, managing editor of thecorporatecouncil.net and deallawyers.com, and I'd like to welcome you to the latest edition of our Deal Lawyers Download podcast. My guest today is Mike Hines. Mike is a partner at Sidley, and he is co-leader of the firm's SPAC practice. He's joining me today to discuss the sweeping new rules that the SEC adopted governing SPAC disclosures and other matters relating to SPAC offerings and de-SPAC mergers. Mike, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks a lot, John. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Great to have you. Can you, let's kick things off by maybe you can just tell our listeners a little bit about your background and your practice.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So I'm a partner in a capital markets practice in Sidley's New York office. I've been practicing nearly 20 years now. I'm representing both issuers and underwriters in, you know, a broad range of debt and equity capital markets transactions, everything from investment grade and high yield bonds to traditional IPOs, SPAC IPOs, follow-on offerings, ATMs. We also represent a number of public companies in their SEC filing and corporate governance matters. But another hat I wear is co-leader of our global SPAC and de-SPAC practice, which has obviously been taking a lot of my time here in recent years.
Sure. Yours and a lot of other folks too, including a lot of folks at the SEC, apparently.
That's right.
Anyway, the SEC's new rules impose a lot of new disclosure requirements on SPACs and also on target companies in de-SPAC transactions. Can you give us, again, I know this is a 500 plus page adopting release here, but can you at least give us a high level overview of those new obligations and what the SEC is trying to accomplish with them?
Sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to. So, you know, and just to level set, these rules were proposed back in March of 2022, and they were just adopted at the end of January and January 24th of the 2024, and they will take effect July 1st of this year. And what Chairman Gensler said, you know, at the time these rules were proposed and also when they were, the final rules were adopted, is that they were, you know, from his perspective, was trying to treat like cases alike, right? So that he's trying to treat SPAC and de-SPAC transactions the same as traditional IPOs, because at the end of the day, when a SPAC combines with a target, with a private target, which is called a de-SPAC transaction, that results in the private company becoming the publicly listed entity. And in the staff's view, it's the same thing as a traditional IPO. So he's trying to, from the staff's perspective, they're trying to align disclosure and liability obligations, you know, with traditional IPOs. So that's sort of the overriding principle with these rules. As you mentioned, it's a very detailed 581-page release, so I won't go into too much detail, but to give you a flavor for the new disclosure obligations, the new rules require, you know, enhanced disclosure regarding SPAC sponsors, including a description of the nature and amount of all compensation they'll receive, as well as any affiliates or promoters. Very prominent disclosure regarding conflicts of interest, any potential actual or potential conflicts between the SPAC sponsor or its affiliates and the public stockholders, as well as extensive disclosure regarding dilution, you know, the dilutive effect of all security issuances to the sponsor, as well as in the transaction, including prominent tabular disclosure up front about that. You know, in addition, there's also a minimum sort of 20 calendar day requirement for the proxy or S-4 being distributed to the public stockholders when they vote on the deal, as well as a requirement that the private target company, you know, be a co-registrant on the S-4 and therefore sort of assume responsibility for all of the disclosures in the registration statement, which has the effect, the practical effect of sort of increasing the liability of the profile, you know, the liability profile for the private target.
Right. And Sidley has prepared a memo that we've included a link in the landing page for this podcast, kind of summarizing these rule changes as well. So you mentioned kind of treating like as like, and that was a big theme throughout what the SEC was doing here. And as part of its efforts to level the playing field with other types of IPOs, the amendments addressed the use of projections by SPACs and sort of changed the Security Act liability landscapes for target company as well, which is something you alluded to. Can you discuss specifically those changes and what they may mean for transaction participants?
Sure. So the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act of 1995, or PSLRA for short, one of the things it did is that it provided a safe harbor when disclosing forward-looking information or projections in SEC filings. But traditional IPOs were not available to take, you know, advantage of that safe harbor. The SEC and its SPAC rules basically carved out, you know, de-SPAC or SPAC transactions from that safe harbor as well, meaning that targets and other SPAC participants are, you know, including any investment banks that may be participating in the transaction, may potentially assume liability for those projections of the target that get publicly disclosed. And that's obviously caused some concern about the potential increased liability profile for all those participants involved. However, it's not all for naught, because there is what's referred to as a bespeaks caution doctrine, which was developed by the cases, by the courts, which basically provides that if you were to include sort of meaningful cautionary language around the projections, enough to inform their reader about the risks and sort of the key kind of assumptions that went into the projections and the risks that they may not be satisfied, that you still would have sort of protection under that sort of bespeaks caution doctrine. Not all is lost there, but it is sort of the loss of the safe harbor, and it does have the practical effect of potentially increasing liability for target companies.
One of the other interesting things in the initial proposal, the SEC had talked about the possibility of a rule that would have resulted in underwriters of a SPAC's IPO being deemed statutory underwriters in a subsequent de-SPAC deal. And it also offered up a proposed safe harbor under the Investment Company Act for SPACs that were able to meet its conditions. Those that didn't, there were all sorts of questions about that. In the final rules, the SEC backed off of that and substituted guidance instead. And what do you think the decision to substitute guidance mean for market participants? And do you expect market practices to change in response to the guidance that's provided in these rules?
Sure. Yeah. And I would say, John, I mean, these are probably the two biggest changes from the initial proposed rules from March of 2022, the sort of backing off the underwriter liability rule, as well as sort of the new safe harbor under the 40 Act, which had been proposed. And you're right, in both cases, the SEC, instead of adopting the rule or the safe harbor, they just opted to include guidance in the final release on these matters. I think, I'll go into it in a little bit more detail, but I think the short answer is that I don't think it's going to have much of a practical difference, because the guidance, in both areas are really sort of facts and circumstances based. There's no sort of bright lines to the SEC's guidance in these areas. And so it does leave a bit of uncertainty as to whether an investment bank involved in a de-SPAC transaction could be considered an underwriter and subject to sort of heightened underwriter liability under the Securities Act. And it sort of leaves to the SPAC and SPAC sponsor to decide, after consideration of all of the facts and circumstances, whether they are should be registered as an investment company. So I think that the guidance will not result in really meaningful changes in the marketplace. I think we've seen since the underwriter liability rule, which was 140A, was proposed, participants in de-SPAC transactions, the market practice has changed. You saw a lot of investment banks withdraw from being involved in SPACs and de-SPACs. And for those that remained, they sort of insist on receiving comfort letters from auditors and 10b-5 legal opinions from law firms and doing extensive due diligence, to support a due diligence defense, if those investment banks were considered to be underwriters. I think that's going to, even though this Rule 140A was not adopted, I think that's going to continue to be the market practice in deals where investment banks are involved. Just in light of this guidance, there's certainly the view of the staff that in some situations, investment banks can be considered underwriters and subject to underwriter liability. So I think the long and short of it is, I think there have been certain market practices we've observed over the last 2 years that since the proposed rules came out, in both of these areas, I think will continue. So I think bottom line, it'll be more or less status quo.
So in other words, a shot across the bow was enough to get the market's attention, and people have been modifying things ever since these rules came out.
That's right. That's certainly what I've observed, in the marketplace. Right.
Now, obviously, it's been a wild ride in the SPACs, the market for SPACs over the past few years. And now the regulatory environment has changed significantly as well. Stepping back, based on your experience, your practice, what guidance can you offer sponsors and potential targets and their advisors about managing SPAC deals in this environment?
Sure. Yeah. Look, I think there's going to, let me say first off, I think there's going to continue to be a role for SPACs in the marketplace. I think, we continue to see sort of low levels of companies going public through the traditional IPO route and other routes. And I think there's going to continue to be a role for SPACs, but just certainly not at the level that we saw in 2020 or 2021, which, frankly, is probably healthy for sort of everybody involved in the SPAC ecosystem. We've already been seeing a trend over the last year or two towards, smaller size SPACs, mostly incorporated in the Cayman Islands rather than Delaware, due to sort of a series of decisions in Delaware, largely that sort of looked at SPACs more critically, as well as sort of the excise tax that applies in the US that doesn't generally apply to Cayman SPACs, as well as certain provisions in the front end at the SPAC IPO stage that are such as rights or other provisions designed to sort of encourage public stockholders not to redeem on the back end. I think all of those are improvements to the SPAC model, and I think that we're going to continue to see a trend in those areas. I would say when it comes time to do, when a deal is identified, I think being thoughtful and comprehensive with respect to disclosures on the front end of the process is going to go a long way. And in particular, when it comes to projections, you know, identifying early on what target projections will be shared, you know, how will they be used? Are they just going to be provided to the, you know, a fairness opinion provider? Are they going to be, you know, marketed to pipe investors? And in, you know, making sure that all parties sort of pressure test and do their diligence to make sure that they're comfortable with the disclosures, with the projections, and with, most importantly, with the disclosures around them, and sort of what are the material assumptions and drivers and the risks, you know, that they, you know, of what could happen that could cause them to not meet those projections. I think also identifying early on if you have an, you know, if there's going to be a pipe or some other financing involved, you know, with an investment bank acting as a placement agent, or if an investment bank is otherwise involved as an advisor, to sort of assume that there'll be a need to deliver comfort letters and law firm 10b5 letters, and sort of building that in to the overall timeline of the deal from both a timing and cost perspective, because there are, you know, sort of lead time associated with those items.
Well, that's great. You know, I know, Mike, when the rule proposals first came out, I mean, it was particularly the SPACs were on the decline in the market. And I think people were very concerned that, hey, these rules, if adopted, could drive a stake through the heart of the SPAC business. And it doesn't seem that's the case. I mean, obviously, it's a more challenging environment, but it's one that is still navigable. And as you suggest, there's still going to be a role here for SPACs as a capital markets alternative for companies of which they're the right fit.
I think so. I'm optimistic. It certainly won't be at the levels we saw a few years ago, but I do think there is still a place for this vehicle in the market, and expect SPACs and de-SPACs to continue.
Well, thanks very much, Mike. Appreciate the insights into the new rules, and want to thank you, and thank everybody here for listening. This concludes today's podcast.
Thanks so much, John. It's a pleasure.